You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you in part by Santa Fe County. If you've been looking to go solar in your home, Santa Fe County's Sustainability Office wants you to know that the 30% federal tax incentives are only available until the end of 2019. So if you've been thinking about going solar, now's the time to do it. And if you're not sure where to start, start with Santa Fe County's Office of Sustainability, where you can get a free impartial consultation to help demystify the process and help you calculate upfront just how big a system you might need. Contact them at 992-9832 or visit santafecountynm.gov/publicworks. And the Radio Cafe is also brought to you by Morningstar Senior Living, which is building its newest community on Pacheco Street in Santa Fe. They'll be providing independent living, assisted living, and memory care to make sure that you and your loved ones can live fully and vibrantly in a safe environment. You can reach Morningstar Senior Living at 505-919-7989. That's 505-919-7989, or go to morningstarseniorliving.com and let them know that you heard about it on the Radio Cafe. And by the way, if you'd like to sponsor the Radio Cafe, please contact Henry Lopez. His email is hlopez@sfnewmexican.com. You can reach him at 505-986-3054, or you can go to radiocafe.org and click on New Mexican, and all that info is there. And now to our program. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Lois Rudnick and Jonathan Richards. They are co-authors and co-producers of the play Ever the Twain, which is being performed on May 29th, which is a Tuesday, at 7:30 at the Lenzick Center for Performing Arts. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And welcome back, I should say, because we talked about this several years ago when you did kind of the first iteration of this play.
Well, the first iteration was timed to coincide with the visit to Santa Fe of the original copy of the first folio of Shakespeare's plays. But it was so well received that due to popular demand, mostly from Lois and me, it is being brought back again.
Popular demand by the authors themselves,
there's
ladies and gentlemen. And it's undergone some revision.
Yes, it has. I think we have changed about 30% of the play. One of the things we wanted to do is to make it more resonant with the State of the Union as it is being run by a person whose name I can't mention in public.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about what this play is about. It's called Ever the Twain, and it's about Mark Twain and William Shakespeare. And the play, the premise of the play is kind of a time travel meeting between the two of them.
Right. It's not so exactly time travel as, I suppose you would say, condition travel. They are traveling from the other side of the great divide, the bar that we all shall cross at one time or another.
Right.
And they are coming back to this stage on this night just to get a little acquainted and to look at the ways in which their careers and their talents fit together and which ways they contrast. And one of the main thrusts of it is to look at the influence and the effect that Shakespeare had on the development of Mark Twain and indeed on Twain's entire American century. The 19th century in America was a century far more obsessed with Shakespeare than our culture is today.
And far more obsessed with Shakespeare than even people were in his own day.
In Shakespeare's
own day. In England, yes.
It's so interesting. What was it about 19th century United States? I mean, first of all, how could everybody understand? Did everybody learn it in their one-room schoolhouse, Elizabethan English?
Yes. Well, whether they learned Elizabethan English or not, we have a lot of sources that suggest that pioneers moving west, the people, you know, Abraham Lincoln sitting, you know, by reading by the firelight late at night, that the books that were the most universal in frontier homes and around campfires were the Bible and the works of Shakespeare.
And one reason for that, one huge reason for that, which most Americans by now have forgotten since kids are subjected or often feel that way to Shakespeare in high school for the first time, is that Shakespeare was available everywhere in the United States where there were theatrical performers who would do as in the bits and pieces we took of Huckleberry Finn, they would do a bit of Richard III, the sword fight. They'd do the Romeo and Juliet balcony scene. Then they would do some other kind of farcical, what we might call more vaudevillian kind of acting, so that people who were illiterate, like Jim Bridger, who was a genuine frontier man, he appears as a character in the movie The Revenant, in fact, had somebody learn him, as he would have put it, Shakespeare, so he could recite it even though he could not read English.
Amazing.
It is amazing. Shakespeare was for everyone. And he, of course, when he wrote, he wrote for the belly and the members, as the lower class was called, which is why they're called lower class, because presumably they have more going on down beneath their belly than they do up above in their heads. It's a very ugly way to think about how we designate class, but he wrote for everyone, whether people were literate or not, and they were right there in the pit, you know, in the theater during his time. He wasn't just for the elite, the erudite, the educated, the gentry, which is pretty much what he began becoming, even in the United States, by the 1870s and 80s.
And one of the things, talking about, as Lois just was, the itinerant players who would perform Shakespeare in small towns, in tents on frontier stages, and in the cities, of course. But they were mostly, in the first part of the 19th century, they were mostly English performers, English traveling companies. The first great American Shakespearean interpreter, the first superstar of Shakespeare in the American stage, was a man named Edwin Forrest. Forrest was a Philadelphia boy and grew up to become an interpreter of Shakespeare that we would laugh off the stage today, but was considered very brawny and muscular and very over the top, of course. And one of the things that we get to in our play is an event of which a lot of people, including us before we really got into looking at this, are not aware, which is the circumstances surrounding the Shakespeare riots of 1849. And the Shakespeare riots of 1849 came basically out of a growing and increasingly bitter feud between Edwin Forrest and the great English, the John Gielgud of his day, was an actor named William MacReady. And William MacReady and Forrest had been friends at one point, I suspect, probably with a little patronizing quality on MacReady's part. But they fell out and they became bitter enemies. And the Shakespeare riots, they are also known as the Astor Place riots, which took place in 1849, took place essentially because of these two actors appearing a couple of blocks apart in dueling productions of Macbeth, and their supporters were, MacReady's supporters were essentially the upper crust, you know, Washington Irving and Herman Melville and the people who were the well-fixed of New York. And
that was not Melville, though, I must say. He never really made a lot of money, but that's okay.
But he supported it. He was of that crowd.
Yes, he was indeed.
Forrest supporters were the hoi polloi. This was a riot that was drummed up by agitators they went into the bars, they went to the baseball fields, they went to the slums and said, are we going to let this hoity-toity Englishman come here and push our Edwin Forrest aside? And so a crowd of about 10,000 people showed up in Astor Place, where the fancy theater was, to which MacReady was appearing, and it turned violent and ugly. The New York City police at that time were not armed with anything other than billy clubs. They had to call out the state militia. State militia fired on the crowd, and a number of people were killed.
20 people were killed and many more injured.
And it was as a direct result of that that American police forces began to be armed with guns.
Because of Shakespeare and because of dueling productions of Macbeth, I was reading that in the play, and I was like, is there anything comparable today? I mean, where people are arguing over something that everybody considers a really great cultural achievement and over the interpretations of it.
Yeah.
This was less about interpretation than it was about race, ethnicity, and class, because a lot of the riffraff, as they would have been called, who came to throw things at MacCready on the stage were Irish, who hated the British for all the reasons, of course, that we know, and who, in a sense, felt themselves very American at this moment by supporting Forrest, who was, you know, as John said, this kind of brawny hunk,
right,
who sort of stood for the wild, savage, you know, Western frontier, which most of America was thought to be, even New York, by European visitors.
How did the two of you get the idea in the first place to put together William Shakespeare and Mark Twain?
It happened because of a course I was teaching at Renaissance, which is our lifelong learning institute here in Santa Fe. I was offering a course called The Late Dark Mark Twain. And it was mostly about the later works he wrote that are extraordinarily brilliant satire on imperialism, religion, and race. In fact, his later books on race, I think, are much more interesting than Huckleberry Finn, as much as I love that novel. And I walked into class one day and I said to my students, you know, I was just thinking this morning when I was getting ready for class that Mark Twain spent his entire life, from the day that he was born, jealous of Shakespeare, wanting to achieve his renown internationally.
How do we know this?
We know this because he wrote about it. So the very first sentence of Mark Twain's autobiography goes like this. I was born in Hannibal, Missouri in 1835, population 100. Thus I added 1% to the population, which is more than anyone else can claim, even Shakespeare.
Wow.
And it was like the gun goes off, he's running. And he spent his life bodlerizing, parodying, writing a closet drama that was too dirty for him to read to his wife, but his minister loved it, called 1601, A Fireside Conversation in Shakespeare's England, which we perform the cleanest piece of, which is all about...
Of which there is none.
Of which there is none, but at least this is something that most people could contemplate listening to, which has a lot to do with who made the loudest fart that Queen Elizabeth had ever heard and is unwilling to own up to it.
So it's a family show.
It's a family.
Definitely a family show. That's as racy as you can get.
It is as racy.
Children love things having to do with smells and sounds.
Absolutely.
Another thing that is part of this patchwork or puzzle of Twain's addiction to Shakespeare and competition with Shakespeare is that Twain was certainly a leading voice, a strong voice among the Shakespeare doubters, the people who do not believe that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare. There was a woman named Delia Bacon in the middle of the 19th century who fancied herself descended from Roger Bacon, Sir Francis Bacon, excuse me, and she advanced her illustrious ancestor as the real author of Shakespeare's plays, and a lot of people subscribed to that theory. Then, since then, there have been probably a dozen other claimants. The Earl of Oxford is one of the principal ones. And in our own community, there have been voices advancing the name of Lady Mary Sidney as the distaff claimant.
That's right.
Yeah.
Twain even wrote a book called Is Shakespeare Dead? In which he advanced this
thesis. And he was, of course, hoping to prove that he should be dead, because he wished to wear the mantle of the bard. And a lot of this was kind of, even though Twain was adored in England and all over the world, this was cultural rivalry, because Americans and American culture was so often described by European visitors as derivative, vulgar, and imitative, not worthy of any real civilized country. Okay, so you can plant things and you can build things and you're good, you know, entrepreneurs, but essentially you have no culture.
And this is essentially the same conflict that created the riots.
Exactly the same conflict that created the riots. And Twain really gets that, and he milks it as much as he can.
So Mark Twain and William Shakespeare were cousins?
Yes. Isn't that amazing?
Apparently almost everybody is cousins if you look
Well, we're cousins with our dogs, too, if you go back far enough. But
I would say it was not a close relationship, much like the relationship between, aren't Donald Trump and Barack Obama cousins? Or maybe it was George Bush, but I know that one of those,
And I thought it was Queen Elizabeth.
Well, okay, wait a minute.
They're eighth cousins, eight times removed, which makes them quite distant from one another.
Okay, so it's like eight greats on your grandfather.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's in the ballpark.
Yeah.
So Shakespeare, as you said, was really popular in the 19th century United States, including during the whole period of westward expansion, whatever we may think of that. Here we are sitting in the West. I can imagine that for people traveling and not having a whole lot of cultural contact, mm-hmm. that having like one book,
yes.
that basically has, you could make an argument, every kind of emotion and conflict conceivable,
yes.
in it,
yep.
which is what Shakespeare does for
absolutely.
Us.
Well,
you have the description by Harold Bloom, one of the great critics and admirers of Shakespeare, who credits him with the invention of the human, that before Shakespeare we did not have a concept of what it was to be human. And Shakespeare, you know, now that may be, you know, going a little overboard.
Yeah, Harold Bloom is a little bit of an exaggerator, perhaps,
yes.
at times. But yeah, you know, so it's just an interesting thing that you've done, because you're putting together, first of all, you're having a whole lot of fun creating the dialogue with the two of them talking to each other.
Mary Charlotte, I have never had this much fun creating anything in my 73 years of life, honestly. And I could never have done it without John. And even though we didn't know each other before we got together to do this, and he was recommended by John Andrews, who was president of the Shakespeare Guild and is very active in all of the Shakespeare performances, Shakespeare in the Garden, everything Shakespeare in Santa Fe today. But truly, it has been one of the great creative delights of my life.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that's fun about it is because Twain quotes Shakespeare so much and is immersed in Shakespeare, there's a lot that is really lifted from,
yes.
well, from both authors,
yes.
but certainly from Twain talking to Shakespeare. And then you get to kind of like have the voice of Shakespeare going, what?
What have you done to Romeo and Juliet?
But another aspect of the relationship that we bring out, and this really is where Lois's idea germinated, is that as they got older, their worldview probably grew a bit darker. They dealt with themes that were darker. So we finish up the evening with a look at the late Twain fulminating about American imperialism. And we match that up with Shakespeare's The Tempest, his final solo play, in which he deals also with colonialism, with an island which could well be the Americas, in the Americas, in which a native is being dispossessed by European invaders.
And it's quite wonderful, because when I grew up and learned The Tempest, Caliban was never presented as anything except, you know, Belly and Members, the savage. There was a transformation when post-colonial studies came about in the 1980s and 90s in academia. There became an entire subgenre known as Caliban studies.
Well, and there's a magazine called Caliban.
Yes. So it was like, you go back and you look at the two speeches that Shakespeare gives him, in which he is not a savage, he's not threatening the virginity of Prospero's daughter Miranda, in which he is saying this island was rightfully mine by my mother Sycorax, or when Miranda says, I taught you English, what an ingrate you are, and he says, yes, and the good of it is that I know how to curse. So it's a Caliban as a proto-rebel and the first indigenous character speaking in English about the consequences of European imperialism in 1612. That's quite amazing.
And we have to also, there's always a tendency to interpret things through the lens of our corrected vision of today. We're as modern now as we have ever been. But you have to look at these characters like Shylock, like Caliban, and in Twain, you know, Huckleberry Finn, Huck and Jim on the river, in the context of their times. These are incredibly enlightened views in the context of 17th century England or 19th century America. Not necessarily. Twain uses some words that offend our current sensibilities, but if you look at the context of the time he was writing in and the points that he seemed to be trying to make, both men are enlarging the view of the humanity of the people who are right. less respected.
Even when they stereotype them. I mean, I always see them as both, you know, you can't escape your times entirely. So they're both subject to the same kinds of stereotypes, but they're able to have, their characters have such dimensionality, at least Jim does, even though he is often criticized as an Uncle Tom figure. He has all the moral wherewithal. He's the only one who really has a packet of moral wherewithal. He is the most distinguished ethical figure in that novel.
The runaway slave in Huckleberry
yes,
Finn,
yes.
whom you in the play compare to Othello.
Yes, yes, indeed. Who also is presented in Shakespeare's play as barbaric and a savage, but also is given a dimension of intelligence and humanity.
And nobility
that goes far beyond any of the white people who are out of their minds with anxiety because he's married one of the daughters of the aristocracy who is white.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe, and we're just going to take a quick break to tell you that the Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. We've had a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies, but very little moisture, and the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. You can visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. Once again, that's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And now back to our program. So we're talking about the play Ever the Twain, which is going up at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center on the 29th of May. Tell us about how this is structured. You, Jonathan, are Shakespeare?
I play Shakespeare, and Forrest Fire, you may know him as Forrest Broadley, a veteran actor around Santa Fe, is stepping into the role of Mark Twain in this production, and we have a mistress of ceremonies holding the thing together, which is being performed by Valerie Plame.
Nice.
And we have a company of very talented players.
And what do the players do?
Well, the players do everything that isn't the three principals. For instance, we talk about Jim Bridger, as Lois did earlier, reciting great speeches of Shakespeare by heart. One of our players will perform that, or when we have the Shakespeare riots, the players will deliver a commentary which is pretty much in the spirit of live-action news, telling you the things as they unfolded. When we do 1601, the Mark Twain parody of Elizabethan England, all of our players will play Queen Elizabeth, they'll play Walter Raleigh, they'll play the various other people involved.
And so it's a full production with music, lighting, everything. It's not just like a kind of reading.
It is
dialogue.
A reading, but it is a staged reading, not just a seated reading. In other words, the actors will have scripts in hand, but they will be moving around the stage, and we have lighting and
very
music
effective and, lighting for Satan, especially.
It's a full theater experience, but it is reading. It is being read.
Okay.
And you mentioned before that it is going up on May 29th. It is also coming down on May 29th.
One night only. Get your tickets soon.
Excellent. This play is educational. This mm-hmm. play is fun. Clearly, you guys had fun writing it. It's funny at times. There's also a lot of depth to it, and I wondered what the kind of deepest pieces were for you guys. I mean, you've talked about it to some extent. There's these deep issues of class, of the relationship between England and the United States. There's a lot about our own identity in it.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, the play for me grew out of, as I said, the late dark Mark Twain, who almost nobody knows. I've taught this course 3 times, and none of the students in my class ever had read any of the material. And I think one of the reasons is that it's extremely difficult material. It is very radical politically. It bludgeons the coarseness of the United States turning from interior colonialism in the Spanish-American War to exterior colonialism and possessing territories and sending forces to destroy innocent men, women, and children. Mark Twain wrote a piece called The Killing of 600 Moros that if you took out the word Moro, it would sound like the My Lai Massacre. So this is the Twain that communists in Russia embraced and were convinced that capitalists in America had bodlerized and, you know, sort of covered up and obscured because he was this beloved all-American guy who wrote this story about slavery after slavery was long over. So it was kind of a safe time to write about slavery in 1884.
Now, bodlerized?
Thomas Bodler was a moralist who cleaned up Shakespeare. He is definitely tied into Shakespeare. He wrote or edited a collection of Shakespeare's plays called The Family Shakespeare, in which he took out anything that the Victorians considered naughty or close to the edge and cleaned it up to make it presentable for family consumption.
So Romeo and Juliet didn't consummate their, like, what?
I'm sure they didn't. Yeah, they probably held hands. But the thing about Shakespeare's presentation, Baudelaire wasn't the only one. People rewrote Shakespeare to suit the audiences they were performing to or their own predilections and prejudices. So you did have, there was a woman named Charlotte, I can't remember her last name, who was one of the, who performed in drag as a man and was one of the popular interpreters of Shakespeare playing Romeo and playing all these different parts. But they would change the endings if they thought,
oh my goodness.
Disney.
Yeah, they would give Romeo and Juliet a happy ending. Oh, she wakes up again and he's still there.
Right. So, they had cell phones.
So they could call each other.
Right.
He'd know she wasn't dead.
So the American 19th century idolized and worshipped Shakespeare, but they didn't keep their hands off.
Right.
They were perfectly willing to adjust to suit whatever the current taste was.
And the same thing was true for Twain. Huck Finn was banned. It's considered to be the most banned book in American literature. That might be hyperbole, but it's one of the most banned books over the course of 100 years for different reasons. Huck was considered to be a terrible role model for middle-class white Victorian boys because he did not speak standard English, and he did naughty things and drank and helped a runaway slave.
And he was free.
And he was free in a way that little boys were not supposed to be free. They were supposed to be tamed and civilized.
Exactly.
And then 100 years later, there was a huge controversy over the fact that Mark Twain uses the N-word to describe black people in the South so many times in the book that African-American parents and their kids became very uncomfortable about the fact that this was the only book ever taught to children in the American public schools, probably until the 1970s and 80s, where white and black and other children of different races actually met a black person. And they felt that Jim was both an Uncle Tom kind of figure and that the use of that slur word was not right for their own children. I mean, it became a kind of cause célèbre, even with the NAACP in the 1950s, this book. So there was a black scholar who rewrote Huckleberry Finn using the word Negro for every N-word.
And that it was like a search and replace.
Exactly. Only there weren't computers available,
right, right.
I don't think, when he did this.
Right, right.
To be able to do that. So all of these issues, you know, there's no human issue, no public issue, no cultural issue, no ethical issue, a race issue that isn't part of both what they wrote and what surrounds them as the most iconic writers of their countries, of their nations.
In the same way that there are people who have serious and legitimate issues with the Merchant of Venice and the depiction of the Jew in The Merchant of Venice can be offensive to contemporary audiences, and yet it is a humanizing of a class of people in Victorian England who were never considered as human. The Jew of Malta is a perfect example of the way Jews were considered,
right,
very much like the Protocols of Zion.
Yes.
One of the things that this play brings up, and the study of Shakespeare and of Twain, is the whole question of whether humankind ever really progresses. And there's a lot of people who call themselves progressives, and a lot of our listeners are progressives, a lot of people in Santa Fe are progressives. And then you read stuff like, I took a little piece out of the play where Twain says, "I began to see the United States as damning itself to a hell of capitalist greed that extended beyond its shores by grabbing other lands and claiming mm-hmm. this was the nation's God-given right."
Yep.
That's well over, what, a century ago,
yeah,
right?
1898.
Yeah. And so you have things like that. And, of course, Shakespeare, I mean, we haven't outgrown vengeance and imperialism and all. I mean, just name your bad thing,
right,
that humans have not progressed beyond. And it really kind of makes you think, like, what is this notion of progress?
Well, it was in the 19th century America, it was considered to be a law of nature, that everything got better in every way, and that's just the way that God meant it to be, and it happened. So it allowed Americans who were manifest destinarians, among others, to convince themselves that everything we were doing to indigenous peoples, Native Americans, and later, you know, going on to get colonies, which is not something our founding fathers ever expected us to do, was really for the better good because we were civilizing. I mean, we got that from England, and, you know, it would pick up the white man's burden and civilize the savage and give them English and let them learn to wear clothes and let them learn to read our books, which I don't know how Shakespeare in 1612 had the forethought to give Caliban that speech, to have him know this. It's incredible. And so a lot of it was just a belief that this is the way things should be. The only good Indian is a dead Indian was the mantra of the U.S. military as it made its way westward. When we started boarding schools, it was kill the Indian, save the man. And that was considered to be much more righteous and humane than just putting Indians on reservations and leaving them there in poverty. So it's amazing how much we can mythologize justifications for doing good when we're doing evil. Not just us Americans, but pretty much any empowered country that has an aggressive tendency to want to claim more lands and peoples.
The play is called Ever the Twain, and once again, it's on May 29th at 7:30 at the Lensic. What are your plans for this play after this one night and one night only show?
Well, let me just say that I want to say the full title, if that's okay, which is Ever the Twain, Shakespeare in Mark Twain's America, because that's really the essence of it. And also that it's a fundraiser for the Lensic, for the Santa Fe Botanical Garden, and for Shakespeare in the Garden. So all the money that doesn't go to putting on the performance will go to those entities. And tickets are from $15 to $100. For $100, you get to sit in the first six seats and hear me laughing hysterically in the first row at every line. But I'll try not to ruin
because
everyone's...
Because I haven't heard them before.
John and I actually have been invited to do a Colore segment with KNME Television, PBS, in Albuquerque called The Battle of the Wits, in which we kind of duke it out with an interlocutor who asks us questions and tries to get us to sort of pit ourselves against one another in terms of, I'm in Twain's corner, he's in Shakespeare's corner. And we're very excited about that.
We also have the aforementioned John Andrews has been looking into the possibility of a performance in New York at the Players Club, which is a venerable institution on Gramercy Park. And Lois, who is, you know, probably has some of the same DNA as the Energizer Bunny, has been working tirelessly, beating the bushes and trying to find possible academic venues for performing this and theatrical venues. We are not resting, by which I mean Lois is not resting until every avenue has been pursued.
Because I feel like, especially for young people, this is such... High school kids could do this. They're college kids. What a way to introduce especially Shakespeare, who's considered the untouchable one, the one where you have to read 400 footnotes to understand anything that he's saying, to make these, and Mark Twain's always been human, but the vernacular he writes in is as difficult for kids today in schools as Shakespearean English is in some way. So it's not like he's an easy read either. And to bring to contemporary audience and to young people a portrait of these two fellas as feisty and smart and amazingly interesting and extraordinarily funny without even having to use a four-letter word. They can be extremely witty and even vulgar.
Yeah, there's a whole list of insults.
Right. That is incredible. You know, and I just feel like this is such a teachable play because the educational part that you refer to is, you know, it's painless. It really is. I mean, you're learning, but you're having such a good time while you're learning that you're learning enjoyably. And it's...
Which is pretty much the experience we had in writing it. We were learning a lot as we went along and saying, wow, look, isn't this great? This is pretty, really interesting.
And the actors loved it. You know, actors from anywhere could perform this. They love doing it. They're doing it for so little money that I'm too embarrassed to tell you what we're paying them.
So producers out there in podcast land, which extends around the world.
Yes.
Take note. Lois Rudnick and Jonathan Richards are writers and co-producers of the play Ever the Twain, William Shakespeare in Mark Twain's America. There I've said the whole title. You can get tickets at ticketssantafe.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
What a pleasure.
So great
Thank
to see you.
You
Mary Charlotte.
Thanks.